A reading from the book of Revelation, chapter 21, verses 1 through 6. Found on page 2335 of your Pew Bible, I believe. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the home of God is with mortals. He will dwell with them as their God. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away." And the one who is seated on the throne said, "See, I am making all things new. Write this, for these words are trustworthy and true." Then he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water as a gift from the spring of the water of life." In our hearing, our speaking, our living. Let me just tell you from the start that this was one of the hardest sermons I've written. And I'm not quite sure why, except that I'm going to talk about an experience that Alice Franks and I shared. And it was a very powerful experience for me, and I'm anxious to be able to convey it to you and to tie it appropriately with the good news of Revelation that we just heard. Let me first address what exists now in this country. And every time I tip my head up, the sound dies. So if I don't look at you, that's why. I imagine many of you are old enough to remember Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address to our nation, in which he warned of the dangers of a military-industrial complex. I don't think it's a stretch to say that now America faces another threat, the immigration-incarceration complex. The Stewart Detention Center, where Alice Franks and I went 2 weeks ago, is the largest immigrant detention center in the United States, and therefore probably in the world. It houses approximately 2,000 men in what was built as a medium security prison. It still functions that way. The plain brick building is located in the middle of Stewart County, Georgia, a rural county whose median income is $22,000. The county seat of Lumpkin, outside which Stewart sits, is a dying southern town of boarded up shops on Main Street. The closest hotel is an hour away in Columbus, and the only restaurant in town closes at 4 p.m. It's almost impossible for the families of the men at Stewart to get there to visit them. It's made no easier by the prison's limit of 1 one-hour visit per detainee per week. None of this is by accident. We were assured that the purpose of most of this isolation is to break the spirits of the people who are detained at the center. To enter the prison, you go through a series of locked gates, each one locking behind you before the next one opens. The fences are topped with coils of barbed wire. The waiting room, which seats only about 10 people, resembles a small town DMV office, with the exception that the security gate through which you must be allowed if you need to use a restroom during your hours-long wait. You are allowed to bring nothing but your driver's license into the facility. Car keys must be put in a locker. If you're lucky, one of the friendlier guards might take pity on you and give you a nonverbal signal that it's best if you don't drink the water from the water fountain. And these are the conditions faced by the visitors. The prisoner I visited was a young Arab man who spoke four languages fluently. Fortunately, these included English. He had no interest at all in discussing his stay at Stewart, and I did not lead him to discuss it. The staff at El Refugio, where we were briefed before we went to the prison, made it clear that we should follow the lead of the person we were visiting. If they wanted to discuss their circumstances, we would. If they wanted to discuss something happier and more cheerful from the rest of the world, we would. So the young man I visited talked mostly about his American girlfriend and his family, who are all back in the Arab country he left, and his interest in soccer. He has applied for voluntary deportation, although he will never be able to return to his home country or to the United States. He hopes that his girlfriend will join him in Panama, where he has been told he could have a new life. Others with us heard more disturbing stories from the men they visited, of attempted suicides, of worm-infested and insufficient food, of ICE officers who taunted them when they were picked up, refused to give them food or water, or let them use the bathroom. So how does all of this tie into Dwight Eisenhower and the military-industrial complex? Well, Stewart is run by a private corporation called CoreCivic, one of the two largest private prison corporations in America. They recently changed their name from Corrections Corporation of America as part of an image repair program after their prisons were investigated on multiple charges of human rights violations. As part of their new logo, or their new image, they designed a new logo, and their website, if you look at it, gives this full detailed description of what the logo is supposed to convey about the values of the corporation. It is basically a distorted American flag, and I don't think they realized the symbolism of that logo when they chose it. These industries have tremendous lobbying power. They negotiate quotas and minimum payments regardless of numbers of prisoners, driving ICE to detain more and more of the people in our communities. Privately owned prisons are run for profit, and that says most of what you need to know, because it results in what is essentially a slave labor system. The company uses the detainees to perform virtually all of the functions of the prison. They do the cooking, the cleaning, the laundry, but oh, I forgot, it's not slave labor because they are actually paid. They are each paid $1 to $4 per day. Besides, if you talk to the people at CoreCivic, they will tell you that the prisoners volunteer to do this labor so that they will have extra spending money. Never mind that without the paltry wage they earn, they could not buy the food they need from the corporation's commissary to supplement their inadequate diets. And a carton of milk at the commissary costs $8. 8 days of labor to buy a carton of milk. Alas, this is not the only business profiting, which is why I refer to it as a complex. Unscrupulous attorneys are taking their cut as well, accepting cases in which there is absolutely no chance of a positive outcome at great cost to the immigrant families who struggle to pay them. And then the attorneys simply phone in to the immigration court to represent the clients they have never met. And we mustn't forget the disreputable bail bond companies. There are some that are good, which get clients out of Stewart by putting ankle monitors on them at a cost to the families of $485 a month, none of which goes toward paying off the original bond that is owed. You may see a connection with the hymn I selected that we just sang, and the verse that reads, "O shame to us who rest content while lust and greed for gain in street and shop and tenement wring gold from human pain." Well, this is all pretty depressing, and I'm sorry. But now let me tell you about Marty Rosenbluth, because here's where the story gets good. And excuse me. Marty is a diminutive, bearded Jewish attorney from Durham. Marty agreed to take deportation cases for his law firm on the condition that he would not take hopeless cases because Marty won't take clients' money under false pretenses. He commuted from Durham for a while before he realized that with the cost of living being what it was in Lumpkin, Georgia, it was actually cheaper for him to buy a house than to visit and stay in a hotel. A hotel in Columbus, Georgia costs about $100 a night, and Marty was able to buy a house with a mortgage of $94 a month. So he is now the only private attorney in the city of Lumpkin. He does have a trailer in his backyard, which is occupied by another attorney. This one is from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Marty told us that he had finally lived out the Southern dream. He has a house with a trailer in the backyard. It's from Marty that Alice and I learned much of what we now know and much of what I told you. He explained the workings of the immigration courts. We were not aware of the four major differences between criminal and immigration law. In an immigration court, you are guilty until proven innocent. There is no right to discovery. You do not have the right to remain silent. And if you cannot afford an attorney, one will not be appointed for you. So when young law interns come to work with Marty, he tells them all this, and that there's no money in it, and that there is only a 4% statistical chance they will win their case. In all the other prisons in America, or immigration detention centers, that number is 45%. But most of the judges at the Stewart County Immigration Center are retired ICE judges, military judges, and former prosecutors. Now, it didn't take long before somebody in the group asked Marty, "Given all of this, why do you do it?" And Marty told us a story that you have undoubtedly heard, but I'm going to tell it to you just in case there's one person here who does not know this story. A really bad storm had washed thousands of living starfish up onto a beach where they would surely dry out and perish as the water receded. A little boy was walking along the shore, picking up one starfish after another and tossing each back into the surf. A man observing this approached the boy and said gently, "There are thousands of these starfish. You know you can't possibly make a difference." But the little boy looked up at him as he flung another starfish into the sea. "I made a difference for that one." Marty Rosenbluth has a starfish tattooed on his wrist. So there's another verse to the hymn we just sang. And it's the first verse, and I'll repeat it. "O holy city, seen of John, where Christ the Lamb does reign, within whose four square walls shall come no night, nor need, nor pain, and where the tears are wiped from eyes that shall not weep again." It is this hope that I'd like to focus on now, for it is the hope given in Revelation. And what are we to make of it? There are as many ideas about the kingdom of God as there are theologians. I did a semester's independent study on it with Gail O'Day, and I still can't define it for you. Jesus' words on the subject are quite mysterious and often contradictory. Most of his parables are intended to describe the kingdom. He would say, "The kingdom of heaven is like," and then tell a story about a woman who lost a coin or a man who owned a vineyard. And the disciples would simply look confused. Then they would ask if they could sit next to him in a place of honor in this kingdom when it came. And poor Jesus, I am sure, put his head in his hands and sighed. At various times, he would tell his followers to be ever vigilant, for the kingdom would appear when they least expected it, like a thief in the night. When asked when the kingdom would come, he said that no one knew except the Father. Then again, he would say, "It will come in your lifetime." And in Luke 17, he said it wasn't coming at all, that it was within them. So I could end my sermon here by saying that things on earth seem to be a mess, and I don't know when or if the kingdom is coming. But Jesus spent an awful lot of his time talking about the kingdom of heaven, and I believe that it is real. And I believe that we will experience it. So I believe that it may be what we encounter when we die, which is the traditional view of heaven, or it may be what will replace this world when this world finally ends. Or perhaps it is something we can create right here and right now. Maybe not in our lifetime, but as the Talmud says, you must not feel obligated to complete the work, but neither are you allowed to quit. So I end the sermon with many questions, but even more hope. And with these last two verses of the hymn, "Give us, O God, the strength to build the city that has stood too long a dream, whose laws are love, whose ways are servanthood, and where the sun that shines becomes your grace for human good. Already in the mind of God that city rises fair. Lo, how its splendor challenges the souls that greatly dare, and bids us seize the whole of life and build its glory there." Amen.